The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. This is Garner Ted Armstrong with the good news of the world tomorrow. Have you ever noticed how when things go wrong, people blame God for it? And when things are going right, they claim he's dead? Anywhere from the golf course to a tornado, some disaster in weather, to some minor little point of life, whether it's the housewife who left the iron on and burned a hole in her skirt, or somebody who missed a 15-foot putt. They use the name of God in trying to find a causative factor for it. But when things are going right and when things are going good, we figure sin is relative, morals are no more, and God is dead. It's sort of a paradox of human nature. Here is a poem, or I guess it would be more appropriately called a song, published in the News and Observer. It's entitled, God is Dead. It was a ritual presented during a chapel service at North Carolina Wesleyan College in Rocky Mount. I want to read just a couple of points of this clipping to you. The reader is supposed to say, now we must wonder, was he only our dream, a dream painted across the sky? The chorus answers, and in the beginning our fear created him. And in the beginning our fear created him. It concludes finally at the end of a very hopeless and useless series of words. Your God is dead. He died in the darkness of your image. He died because he grew ill from your dreams of salvation. He died because you held his hand too tightly. God is dead. You know, that's becoming quite a popular belief today. It was said in the report on the first reading of this in liturgical form that the reaction ranges all the way from tears to a new enthusiasm for theology. That's interesting. It was so hopeless, some people just sat there and cried. Others thought, now there's a theology I can believe in. It's easy to believe in a dead God. If you leave God out of the picture, that's the religion for me, they figured. But a living God, one that has laws, one that says do this or do the other, no, that's not for me. That's the way people reason today. Now, a theologian recently said sin is relative. Ordinarily, lying is considered wrong, but when it would save an innocent person, he theorized, then a lie takes on a modified moral quality. As some see it, the general wrong becomes a particular right. Now, trying to make heads or tails out of this is a little difficult, but I'll try to help him by trying to help explain what he meant. I'm not sure I know, and I'm not sure he knows, but he said what is right depends on the situation, and of course this is the whole working viewpoint of what is being called today the new morality. It's variously called contextual morality or situation ethics. Sort of funny, isn't it? It holds that every decision on whether an action is good or bad hinges not on the act itself or on any law, but on whether it would help others in the context of the situation. Sin occurs, this theologian said, when laws are put ahead of human welfare. For instance, he said, now here's where you have a little trouble understanding what he meant by this. He said, adultery is not wrong in itself, but it's ordinarily wrong because the overall emotional, legal, and spiritual effects are hurtful rather than helpful. Oh, I see. Then he says, the effects caused by adultery are hurtful. Then he turns around and says, but actually adultery isn't necessarily wrong in itself. So people aren't quite sure what is right, what's white, what's black, what's up, what's down, what's wrong, what's right today. They are, really, but this is the excuse they use. We really are sure. Let's not kid ourselves. I'm not saying people really aren't sure. I should have put it a different way. We're trying to kid ourselves. We are sure, but we don't want to be sure because this is the way that by somehow cuddling up to the arms of the majority, we can all go along and live immorally, we can live licentiously, and we can hope maybe we won't have to pay the penalty. We're not that dumb. We know there is such a thing as cause and effect. We still know what sin is, we just don't like to admit it. And we know that God is not dead. We know that there is a living God, but we're just a little bit afraid to try to prove it. Too many people are spiritual cowards today. They are afraid to ask themselves the really big questions. Does God exist? Can you prove it? Is the Bible his word? Can you prove that? And if you did prove it, would that mean somehow the consciousness or the knowledge of God and the knowledge of his word would hold you accountable? You know, the reason people think they're not held accountable is somehow we've gotten a weird idea. Ignorance of the law is an excuse. That if
you can come to the end of the rope and say, well, I didn't know God existed. I didn't know there was a Bible, that it was absolute authority over my life. I didn't know I was going to have to pay a penalty for broken laws. But maybe somehow you can get off. Well, you won't get off during this physical life. It's just like this theologian. He says, he mentions the word adultery. Well, then he must know what it is. He talks about sin. He talks about laws. Then he must know what these are. He also talks about having bad results in the long run. Therefore, he must know that cause and effect are still active today. That if the effect is evil, then the cause must have directly been the reason for it. You know, it's funny. Today, we just want God to keep his nose out of our business when the going is good. But when the going is rough and tough, we want to blame him for it. Have you ever heard somebody out on a golf course missing a 15-foot putt? A couple of times I thought, well, maybe this is a convention of theologians out here. They're all using the name of God, talking about Christ and talking about God, of course, in loud language. And you want to walk up and ask them, well, what's the matter, fella? Did somebody move the green? Or you want to say, well, now, did somebody move the cup there just as you putted your 15-foot putt that you missed? Or what happened? Maybe an earthquake occurred. Maybe that's why you're blaming God for it. No, we want to use the name of God. We want to blame God when things are going wrong. I told you about the farmers in South Africa who had hung the sign on the fence that said, please throw in your pennies to buy God's spectacles so we can see the suffering of both man and beast. Isn't that amazing? We want to blame God when things are going wrong. But when things are going good, we've got time to sit around and kid ourselves. There isn't any God. Because we want to be free with untroubled consciences, free to do what we want to do, to whom we want to do it, when we get good and ready to do it. We want to cheat and admit it cheerfully, to lie and not pay the consequences, even to kill and then to tell the jury, well, it depends, I had a motive, or I was temporarily insane. So today people say good is absolutely relevant, that good is completely dependent upon the circumstances, and so is bad, and we say we can't quite be sure what is bad and what is right. But you know, that's not too much of a new thing, and it's not necessarily an atheistic or even an agnostic's view. I have before me a little clipping from a purely religious source. Matter of fact, it was an advertisement from a church. And it was real interesting to me because I've asked this question over the World Tomorrow so many times, and the caption is, what is sin? Here's the title of the ad. It has a little clipping to say you'd like to learn more about this particular church, which I won't identify. But it says, what is sin? And here, and I'm going to quote, but on this subject of sin, let's ask, just what is it? I'm still quoting, the way we look at it, that is, the way it's interpreted to us, sin is defined as the error of imposing our own wills over God's will. End of quotation. Isn't that terrific? Right out of a newspaper article. Now, this was published by a very large church group, possessors of, I would assume, millions of Bibles. And every one of those Bibles have a scripture found back in 1 John 3 and verse 4, which says, sin is, and then gives you the answers to what it is. But I was interested in seeing what they had to say about it, because they said, the way we look at it. Isn't that interesting? That's exactly what most people would say. Well, the way I look at it is, or my opinion is, and of course your opinion is good as somebody else's. So it doesn't make any difference whether you're talking about new moralists or whether you're talking about older theologians. They all have the same view. It sort of depends on the way you look at it. Now, you know better. From your earliest childhood, you knew you could depend upon absolutes. When you were cold, when you were hungry, when you burnt your finger or cut your foot, you learned there were definite causes, and you learned there was a way to solve the problem. Later on, you learned social ostracism might result from being a little bit hard to get along with. Maybe you were left out of sandpile, wading pool, or jump rope, and it made you unhappy. And you began to realize there is a way to win friends, and there is a way to lose them. Certain actions tend to make friends for you, and some actions tend to repel people. And you found there are absolutes even in human relationships, and you knew cause and effect. You learned about the laws of physics, of inertia, gravity. You can see them today in advertising. They say if you eat too much and eat too fast, swallow our pill, we'll fix it for you. Talk about smoker's throat. On the one hand, they say, please smoke our brands. They don't dare say if you're going to take up smoking. If you're about to start, you're 15, you want to find out which brand to choose, start with ours. This, I think, would get a lot of parents and others up in arms, and so what they do is to try... It's unethical. You would think religions don't dare do it, but smokers do. Actually, the tobacco companies do. They try to get you to change from one to the other. Wouldn't that look silly if you had a group of Baptists in front of the Methodist church with signs saying, change for good, come across the street to ours? You know, you could have a near riot in the local community, but the cigarette manufacturers get away with it somehow. I don't know how, but they do. They say, change, move up, move ahead, come on up, come out. It's always an appeal to vanity to make you conscious of the fact that if you're smoking this one, you're better than somebody else. It's interesting. You can admit worry causes tension because they advertise a pill for it. You can admit that there are all kinds of reasons why you develop night sweats, hallucinations, psychoses, neuroses, fits, and worries, and they can even give you pills and things to calm you down. But now when it comes down to the really big things in life, what causes divorce? What causes all of the financial disaster that's attendant with it? What causes the poor little homeless children and the resultant, oftentimes, juvenile delinquency? People say, well, it couldn't be adultery because that could be right. Aren't we a little bit silly? We mean to say adultery does not cause heartache, frustration, broken homes, wrecked lives, frustrated, disillusioned, fearful children. Sure it does, and we know it does, and the moralists are not right, and they know it, and so do you. There is such a thing as cause and effect, and there are absolutes, and you can prove it. Isn't it interesting? This, to me, is an absolute statement. It's not true, but it's absolute. God is dead, says this little poem. But these very people who have made up this little poem don't claim to believe in absolutes. They say there aren't any such things, and yet they certainly deal with very positive statements, don't they? God is dead. Now, when a man is dead, he's not dead. He's partially dead. His body's dead, but we're not quite sure. People reason around, well, maybe part of him is still living. But when God is dead, the way these theologians figure it, he's all the way dead, friend. He's so far dead that there is nothing there. There's no consciousness, no power whatsoever. When a man is dead, he's been dead for years, but he wrote something, they say the immortal Emerson. They don't say the immortal God. He inspired the Bible. A man can leave works behind him. He's supposed to be immortal. But God, they say today, is dead. Well, God is not dead. You know better. And you can prove better. You want to write for these booklets, Does God Exist, and the Proof of the Bible, and get that cleared up to yourself. Moralists believe in absolutes, all right. Sure they do. They believe in gravity. They believe in the laws of physics and chemistry. They believe in death. They don't know what it is. They're afraid of it, but they believe in it, all right. And they believe in life. They don't know what that is either, and they're a little afraid of that, too. But they know it's there. There are absolutes, laws to live by, and when you break them, there are automatic results. And when you live by them, there are also automatic results. Saying they don't exist is not going to make them get out of the way. Saying they do not exist does not remove the penalty. It's time you prove to yourself God is far from dead, that he lives, and that his word is alive, that the laws of God in the Bible are living laws, not casual suggestions or wise sayings or food for thought. Here is something about sex education for teenagers. Here in the fifth chapter of the book of Proverbs, a warning from God Almighty, inspired in the words of a father written to his son. He said in verse 1 of chapter 5, "My son, attend unto my wisdom, and bow your ear to my understanding, that you may regard discretion, and that your lips may keep knowledge. For the lips of a strange woman drop as an honeycomb, and her mouth is smoother than oil." Oh, he went on to show how it might sound pretty good. The argument, the line, the come on by the crowd, the other fellows who were going the way that all other people are, it might sound pretty good. But the end, he said in verse 4, is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death, and her steps take hold on Sheol, was the Hebrew meaning grave. The grave or the pit or death. Isn't it amazing how what people used to laughingly refer to as social disease, venereal disease, is reaching epidemic proportions in the United States, and principally among teenagers? Isn't it amazing how young marriages are given only about one chance out of 10 of succeeding? Isn't it amazing how the chief cause of death is rapidly becoming suicide among teenagers? Isn't it amazing how, in the face of all of the pressures by the so-called new moralists, do as you please to whom you want to do it when you get good and ready to do it, is leading toward nothing but heartache and sickness and unhappiness? endured wretched, miserable little children born without some of the parts of their very bodies. Here in the laws of God are definite, positive commandments. He said, her feet go down to death and her steps take hold on hell or the grave, lest you should ponder the path of life. Her ways are movable and you can't know them. Hear me now, therefore, O you children, and depart not from the words of my mouth. Remove your way far from her and come not nigh the door of her house, lest you give your honor unto others and your years unto the cruel. Do you want to make yourself a slave to your own passions and lusts? Do you want to end up working for others all your life? Down and out? That's the way to do it. So says your God, so says the Bible. Let strangers be filled with your wealth and your labors be in the house of a stranger, and you mourn at the last when your flesh and your body are consumed. It talks about diseases consuming the body, taking away the energy, the ingenuity, taking away the spark and the little bit of a, call it, electric vigor of the brain, dulling the senses. And say, how have I hated instruction and my heart despised reproof, and have not obeyed the voice of my teachers, nor inclined mine ear to them that instructed me? I was almost in all evil in the midst of the congregation and assembly. Oh, he's a real swinger, they say today. That means he's in the thick of everything. I was in almost all the evil. Now, you know, a lot of people can say that. A lot of movie actors can say that. Marilyn Monroe was. I suppose she could have said that. I don't know, and I can't judge how she lived. All I know is what I read in the papers. It isn't all I know, but I'll say that's all I know about her. I never met her. But I know a couple of positive statements about her. She was famous. She did become a worldwide sex symbol. Everybody always told everybody else that she was attractive and had a lot of appeal. And apparently it was box office. And there's another positive statement about her. She was a success, I guess, if that's what success is. And the next positive statement, she is dead. Now, somehow, it would seem to me that if she had been born in Podunk, Kentucky, or someplace, and she'd met a young fellow who maybe became an elementary school teacher, and they had him a little two-acre farm, and she had maybe eight children, and she were still alive today, and she'd never known all that fame, and at least that one life might have been a success and might have been a whole lot happier than the fact of the death that is a truism today. I suppose a lot of people can brag at the last, say, I was almost in all evil in the midst of the congregation and assembly, that I made it from the length and breadth and up and down of the world. I was a member of the jet set. I did just about everything there is to do. I suppose some people could say that. But every single time they do, they've got another story to tell. They've got another story to tell. And usually that's the one that is anything but success. That's the story about lack of friends. Everybody's out for their money. They'd love, as J. Paul Getty said, just to walk along the seashore some evening and watch a sunset all by himself, because that doesn't cost anything, he said. He said he'd trade all of his millions for just one successful marriage. And the reason he said that is because he's had so many that have been unsuccessful. And the things that people who strive and desire to get more would like to have can't be bought, and they won't learn it. They just will not. There are millions of people today who are absolutely certain that if their income could be increased by as much as 30%, they would be happy. Then there are those people in advertising at $25,000 a year average who said they were unhappy, and every last one of them figured they were underpaid. Then there are those who became millionaires and who say they're unhappy too, because all they do now is worry about hanging on to their millions and worry about relatives grabbing it when they die, or maybe keeping it away from the government. You know, Solomon knew that. Solomon looked around at life the way people are living it in the book of Ecclesiastes. He said he surveyed all there is to behold, the way of man, the way of woman, the way of life, of growing up, of being educated, of coming to position and stature, and then of leaving it all behind for somebody else who didn't earn it and doesn't deserve it. And he said, I looked everywhere around the world at life the way people are living it, and therefore I hated life. He thought, if that's all there is, if there isn't something beyond this, Solomon became a candidate for suicide because he couldn't see the end. And finally, he was inspired at the close of that book to say there is just one real purpose in living, and that's to keep God's laws, to understand his word, and to do what you're supposed to do when you're supposed to do it. Because there is something beyond. Oh, yes, maybe he finally learned there was something beyond, that there is a destiny, there is a purpose in human experience, that there is something beyond just day-to-day, nebulous, purposeless living. He finally learned that, but it took him quite a while. Here are laws youngsters ought to be taught, and it ought to be taught them by their parents who ought to know, and by their teachers. Will they believe it, or will they have to grow up and learn for themselves? People say, well, I'm going to let my child make up his own mind about God. Why do you do that? Do you let him make up his own mind about race? Do you let him make up his own mind? If you would do that, you might be a pretty honest person, but the average person is not that honest. What, if you are a Negro, were you first told when you came running in and asked your mother about that white boy or that white man you'd first seen? Do you remember? Probably you do. You heard about Uncle Charlie, didn't you? And if you are a white person and you heard your parents tell you about the first Negro you ever saw, what did you hear? What was the story you heard about Negroes in general? If you're a white person and you live in South Africa, what were you first told about the Africans? What were you told about Indians, about Asians, about Orientals? Were you told the truth? Were you told every individual ought to be judged based upon his individual characteristics, upon his individual education, his individual honesty and integrity and ability? Were you told that every individual is the same inside, that God has made all humankind of one blood, that everybody is at least possessing of equal opportunities in the sense of life and the pursuit of happiness and liberty? And that doesn't mean people aren't born in slavery, but I mean that every individual ought to be judged individually. No, you weren't told that. You were told, oh, those guys. Or you better beware of them, or you better look out. Uncle Charlie gets you. You were told all kinds of things, but it might not have been the truth. And yet parents can become so broad-minded when it comes to God and the Bible. They say, I want my child to discover the truth for himself. Unless, of course, they belong to one of the large churches, and then they're going to teach it to them so fervently that the chances are they won't have an opportunity to make up their minds for themselves. Now, the point is that children are teachable. The children believe what parents tell them. That's why the book of Proverbs is so good for child rearing, because there's a great deal of instruction found in that book, of teaching, of integrity, of honesty, of sex education, education about handling finances, education about how to work, education about how to study. Now, what are you doing with your children? Well, chances are you're doing about like most other people. You let them sit in front of the automatic babysitter, television, where they're exposed to things you wouldn't let your talking parrot hear. They're exposed to crime and violence, anything from monster movies to weird science fiction, scandal shows, all the intrigue in a little society where it seems like almost everybody's got something going with almost everybody else, and that's amazing. I don't know the population of that place, but it must be tremendous. It must be at least several hundred thousand. They couldn't keep it going that long. People allow their children to watch violence and weird monster shows and scandal, divorce, intrigue, licentious sex, and then they confidently expect that everybody else's child but theirs is going to be a juvenile delinquent. Theirs is going to be fine, an upstanding citizen. Theirs may become the next president, or may be high in business or finance or government or the military. And they're just sure that theirs is going to make up his own mind for himself when he gets of age. Well, it's about time you began to teach your children right out of the Bible that that isn't the way it is. There are absolutes. And doing wrong reaps the wrong results. And living wrongly gives you headaches and heartaches and anything but what you really want. And the good things in life are free. The Word of God is free. The breath you draw is free, even though it might be polluted depending upon where you live. But it's about time you found out there is a purpose in your life, and that in the face of these fantastic days in which you live, of this space age, and worrying about the war in Vietnam and the possibility of a massive land war in Asia, hearing about the possibility of more than 12 million people starving to death in India, worrying about race, about the hydrogen bomb and the space race and who's going to get on the moon first, people just don't know what to make of their personal lives in the face of this fantastic world of today. Well, it's only because they haven't discovered God, haven't discovered His Word, haven't discovered the purpose in their being and drawing breath. It's because they don't realize there is a reason for human experience. There is a destiny ahead for man, greater, more awesome, and far-reaching than anything you've ever thought of before. You live in a transitional period. You live just
on the brink of a new age. A new and a different era, an age that is going to stretch on into the beyond, the world's greatest colonizing period, the period of greater discovery, of greater reform, of greater growth and development than at any other time in the history of the world. But people today are fearful. They're scared to death. We get letters from people saying, don't tell me the truth about world conditions anymore. It scares me half out of my wits. I don't want to hear it. So people increasingly say, in a world such as this is, what's the use? Why bother? Why bother trying to find out right from wrong? They look at the way people are living, they get disgusted with other people. They say, therefore, how can I believe in God? People are people and God is God, and God's laws are good for us, and even though other people disobey them, that does not justify your doing so, nor does it relieve from you the responsibility of obedience to God's laws, nor does it remove from you the penalty of having broken those laws. You can find out what's right and what's wrong, and you can find out living by the right is going to reap the correct rewards, and living the wrong way is going to reap everything you don't really want. You need to write in for these booklets, Does God Exist, and the Proof of the Bible. Now, here are some that go right into day-by-day, workaday situations, applying biblical principles, showing you how you can use them. For example, an article, How to Get and Hold a Good Job, showing you from the Bible how to approach a prospective employer, and showing you how to hang on to a job once you have one. You need to write for this booklet on the Ten Commandments, showing every single one of the Ten Commandments as they break down in day-to-day language, so you can understand how to apply them today in this modern world in which you live. Also, the booklet on the Seven Laws to Success. What is it? J. Paul Getty admits he hasn't quite found it. He's got a lot of money, but what about success? What is success? How do you seek it? How do you know when you have it? The Seven Laws to Success. I don't care whether you're a housewife, a teenager contemplating marriage, or a person in business. You need that booklet. And then this booklet, so important, Why Were You Born? Why bother living? A lot of people wonder today, why stay alive? There are people contemplating suicide. And of course, that's never the answer to anything, is it? That's just the end of everything, because you're completely unconscious, and that's the end of you, period. That's rather final. Life is worth living if you find out why you're alive. So you write for this booklet, Why Were You Born? What is the purpose in human life? Write for the booklets on Does God Exist and the Proof of the Bible. And above all things, get your name on the mailing list of the Plain Truth magazine. And remember to write in for your first sample copy of the Bible Correspondence Course. It begins with the question, Why study the Bible in the space age? Is the Bible relevant? Is it up to date? Does the Bible, as I've been saying, really talk about modern day problems? Does it talk about the future? Does it talk about what's around the corner in world affairs in these 60s and on into the early 70s of the most perplexing, frightening times in the recollection or the history of man? Yes, it does. And this Bible Correspondence Course begins with that question, Why study the Bible in the space age? And makes it clear. And it's illustrated, and it's free of charge. There is no tuition. There's no charge, no price, no follow-up. No one's going to call on you for any of the literature I've mentioned. Request the Plain Truth magazine. Request this booklet on the United States and the British Commonwealth in prophecy. Find out where we are mentioned in the prophecies of the Bible. And then keep listening to every single World Tomorrow program and tell other people about it. Now, all you need to do is to write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. The address is Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. Remember, be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. And so until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.